Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we get started, a reminder that we are in the midst of KABU's Winter Pledge Drive. KABU is commercial-free, volunteer-powered radio made possible by people like you. Not only that, KABU has trained thousands of people how to make radio, all for free, thanks to the support we receive from our members. So help us reach our $15,000 fundraising goal. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. The Oregon Department of Transportation, known to its friends as ODOT, has been displeasing lots of people, whether it's for their excessive post-fire logging along the Santiam Highway last year, or their latest deceptively named proposal to expand Interstate 5, disguising it as a bridge replacement. Today, we talk about what's really going on with ODOT and who determines how the department makes its decisions with urban economist Joe Courtwright, who runs City Observatory, a website and think tank devoted to data-driven analysis of cities and the policies that shape them. Joe, welcome to Locus Focus, and it's a pleasure to have you after all these years of reading your articles.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
I know that you've been a big critic of ODOT, and actually just a few weeks ago, Robert Liberty was on the show, who recommended that I talk to you, and we were talking about the so-called bridge replacement project that ODOT is proposing to go replace the current interstate bridge over the Columbia River. But there seems to be a lot of disconnect between the philosophy that's supposedly driving Oregon to a green, renewable future and ODOT, which is stuck maybe in the 1950s or something like that.
That's putting it generously, yes.
So I wanted to sort of start by talking about what is the mindset at ODOT and why does it seem to be so out of step with where the state wants to seem to be going?
Well, you know, it's called ODOT, but it's really still deep down the Oregon State Highway Department, which is what it's always been. And it exists to build things, to build highways and to build bridges. And the bigger those things are, the better. And it doesn't come any bigger in this case than the so-called Interstate Bridge Replacement Project. It's a lot of concrete, it's a lot of steel, it's a lot of asphalt, it's a lot of money. So it's, you know, it's basically an engineer's dream. But for the rest of us, it's kind of a nightmare.
How is that?
Well, you know, let's just start with the name. You know, they call it the, quote, Interstate Bridge Replacement Project. But it isn't really just about replacing the bridge. It's really a 5-mile-long, 12-lane-wide freeway that will cost about $5 billion and will require tolls, too, tolls of about $5 for each round trip at a minimum. Calling it a bridge replacement is like calling a new $55,000 pickup a tire replacement, because less than 30% of the cost of the project is actually the structure that goes over the river. Most of it is rebuilding and widening the freeway for a couple of miles north and south of the river. And as a result, it's really not a replacement. If we were just talking about replacing the bridge, this would be a very different conversation. But it's an opportunity for these engineers to build this gigantic project.
Well, I'm remembering when they were going to replace the Bay Bridge down in the Bay Area after it fell down in the earthquake in 1989. And some of the first artist renderings I saw just were all these freeway lanes basically going over places like Treasure Island, and there's another island is in the bay that the bridge goes over, and just kind of obliterating communities that are would be under that bridge. It seems to me that there's a real disconnect with engineers between their dream of their engineering vision and how that really fits into the landscape that they'd be building on.
Yeah, and this project is very much the same. And one of the striking things about the project is that despite the big budget and the easily availability of the technology, you'll notice they haven't produced any renderings of what this project would look like, particularly to people standing on the ground. And that's important because it's going to be probably 14 or 16 lanes as it crosses Hayden Island. And it will be very high up in the air because it has to clear the navigation channel for the Columbia River and leave 116 feet of clearance over the river. So it will be, you know, this bridge structure that will be probably as much as 150 feet tall, which is almost as tall as the towers on the bridge currently. It will actually be two bridges side by side, and they'll be each 90 feet wide. So this is a giant structure that will dramatically change the look and feel of downtown Vancouver, and really will turn. Turn Hayden Island into mostly a freeway area covered with flyovers and ramps and lanes of freeway traffic.
Kind of like a freeway underpass, it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly. A giant underpass for Hayden Island.
What are the circumstances that are encouraging ODOT to go ahead with this proposal? Because the last proposal, the original Columbia River Crossing, which was proposed well over a decade ago, got shot down. And it seems like this one isn't very different from that. So why is ODOT going ahead with basically a warmed-over version of what they proposed a long time ago?
I think the same things that motivated them are motivating them now. And clearly, anybody who, travels on I-5, between, 4 and 6 in the evenings in particular knows, it tends to get jammed up. There are a lot of people commuting from homes in Clark County to jobs in Oregon. And then also a whole lot of people who live in Clark County and shop in Oregon to avoid Washington state sales tax. And so the roads are jammed up. People are annoyed by congestion. The highway engineers like to use that as an excuse to build something even bigger. But unfortunately, in the history of freeways in the United States, we know that it's never been possible to build your way out of congestion. In fact, the science on this is so well established that it's called the fundamental law of road congestion. In urban areas, you can widen the road just as much as you want, and it doesn't matter how wide it is, it will fill up with cars.
And why is that?
The big constraint to travel is how quickly you can travel. So if you suddenly make it easier to travel, faster to travel, a whole bunch of people who wouldn't make that trip or would make it at a different time change their mind and travel. So, right now it's almost 4:30 in the afternoon. There's no way in the world that I would go from my home in Northeast Portland to Home Depot up by Jansen Beach at this time of day. But suddenly, if you got rid of some of that traffic, I'd go, hey, oh, maybe I will go to Hayden Island. So we basically rely on traffic congestion and queuing to ration how much road capacity we get. And if we add more road capacity, a whole bunch of people who self-select for not using it will suddenly use it. And the interesting thing is, they're the people who would value it least. So essentially, when you build more capacity, you get a bunch of people who are kind of indifferent about making that trip to suddenly want to make that trip. So in a very real way, building the road causes people to make the trip.
Well, back in the 1970s, when they were still having a hard time deciding how to build I-205 through the east side of Portland, and I moved out to Sandy, and I think at one point in my living in Sandy, 205 made it to Foster Road. That was as far north as it got from Oregon City. And so it was very convenient for us to hop on the freeway down in Clackamas and shoot down to Oregon City. At the time, it was a very pleasant trip. It was through a lot of beautiful countryside. There was no suburban sprawl between Oregon City and Clackamas at that time. And I felt like it was my own personal freeway. Mm-hmm. Well, when they finished the freeway a few years later and it went across the Columbia River into Washington, suddenly it became very congested. And it seemed like everybody had discovered my personal freeway.
Yeah.
So I think there was more than just people deciding it was easier to go, but it seemed it also spawned a lot of development.
Yeah, and that's what we call the second order or long term effects of building roads is and building more freeway capacities is it encourages people to have homes further away. It encourages businesses to have more decentralized locations, and it means everybody ends up driving more and driving further. So the construction of freeways in the United States is a leading cause of the very sprawling development patterns that we have in the United States. And building more capacity leads to more vehicle miles of travel.
Well, back in the 1970s, Portland in particular was a leader in stopping freeways. And there's the famous case of our then mayor, Neil Goldschmidt, stopping the Mount Hood Freeway from going through a neighborhood that I later lived in Southeast Portland. So what happened? between then and now?
This is a great question. In fact, I think this is the most interesting and most salient question here is half a century ago in 1973, back at a time when we had no inkling, I think, of the nature and severity of the climate crisis, and when the environmental movement was just awakening, we as a community had the foresight to say, we don't want to build a freeway. And we canceled the Mount Hood freeway. We tore out the Harbor Drive freeway. And there was community consensus around that. And it, you know, those two events were really very salient in sort of launching, I think, Portland on the kind of trajectory that it's been on since then, which has been very positive in a lot of respects, very strong economic growth, very strong environmentalism. And here we are a half century later, and people seem to have forgotten that the very basic lessons at a time when the environmental crisis is manifest. And, you know, the fact that we're having to have this discussion half a century after, you know, the death of the Mount Hood Freeway is to me a civic tragedy.
Well, also back in that time, there was a little bit of rush hour traffic over the interstate bridge between Portland and Vancouver. But you didn't really have to plan your life when you were going to go across the river around how much traffic there would be. So something else changed in that time that has generated a lot more traffic in Portland, it seems.
Yeah, and you know, people did plan their lives around traffic then. And there was traffic on I-84. And the reason for the Mount Hood Freeway was, I-84, which was actually I-80N back in the day, was the Banfield Freeway was so congested, and so we needed to build more capacity. And even though we didn't build the Mount Hood Freeway, we've still had a very flourishing city. And in fact, the neighborhood that you lived in and parts of Southeast Portland, which I have lived in, are desirable because they do not have a freeway going through them. And if we're really concerned about a healthy economy, Portland has always gotten more economic boost from the things that it didn't build, like the Mount Hood Freeway, or the things that it tore out, like Harbor Drive, than it has ever gotten from building freeways like, say, I-205.
Well, and actually, the reality of it is that I don't think the traffic on I-84, then I-80N, is that much worse today than it was in 1973 or 74. And then they built the light rail, the MAX line.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
It seems like that was a different answer than what we're coming up with today.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the unanswered questions about the IBR, the Interstate Bridge Replacement Project, so-called, is what form of transit they'll do. And, you know, if you're really serious about transit, and I think there are good reasons to expand transit to Vancouver, to Clark County, the last thing that you should do is expand the freeway next to it. if you want the light rail to be patronized, or if Bass Rapid Transit System to be patronized, the last thing you want to do is make it easier for people to commute by car. And this is one of those instances where, you know, this all of the above solution, we'll widen the freeway, we'll do light rail, we'll do all these other things, is actually wasting a huge amount of money. If you really want more capacity, you should do one or the other, but you shouldn't do both.
Well, could you see them building a bridge across, just making a new bridge, no more freeway widening, that was basically a transit bridge with a little bit of space for cars?
You know, I think the real issue here to me is we have a much better way to fix congestion. And in theory, ODOT and the state are committed to it, which is to start pricing our roadways. And the reason that we have traffic congestion in Oregon, in anywhere really, is the same reason why when you go to Ben and Jerry's on free ice cream day, there's a line around the block. And the reason is because you're not charging any price for using the product. And so people will line up for it. And essentially what ODOT has been doing has been running the freeway system as if it were free ice cream day every day. And they perennially will tell you two things. One is, this is terribly congested and we don't have enough money, which is exactly the same boat Ben and Jerry would be in if they tried to do free ice cream day every day. You know, they wouldn't have enough money and they'd be chronically running out of ice cream and people would be lined up for it. So if we really want to get rid of congestion, there's a way to do it, which is to ask people to pay some sort of congestion fee or price to use the road, particularly at the peak hour. And what pricing does, it encourages people who have options to take advantage of them. You know, they could ride the bus, they could take their trip at a different time, they could shop closer to home rather than taking a long shopping trip, and so on. And it actually doesn't take convincing a lot of people to change when they make their trips to have the freeway system work a lot better than it does. And so a very modest system of road pricing could make congestion go away. And in fact, cities around the world are doing that. London is doing that. Stockholm is doing it. Singapore has done it for decades. Milan is doing it in Italy. So it's very possible. The technology is there. If we don't want congestion, if we price the roadway, we would suddenly discover that we have plenty of capacity.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland. Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with urban economist and opinion leader, Joe Courtwright, about what's really going on with ODOT and who determines the department's decision-making process. And before we continue, I want to remind you that now is a good time to become a member of KBOO during our Winter Pledge Drive. KBOO programming focuses on local communities, artists, activists, and people like you. Join now and help us meet our $15,000 goal. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or you can mail a check to KBOO FM, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'd like to get back to this whole conundrum that I'm feeling about why is it at ODOT, where they are, I guess, are they setting policy or they just come up with great dreams that then they try to get funded, that it goes so counter to what so much of the Oregon trajectory since the 1970s has been?
I think it's just an agency that came of age and defined its identity at a time when America was building lots of roads and building the interstate highway system. And that's how they define success, as building things. Bridges and highways, particularly big ones, are kind of the most compelling thing to them. And the tragic thing is, I think they're in complete denial about the climate crisis. And I'll just give you one example of that. So as you probably know, we pay for roads in Oregon largely from gasoline taxes, fuel taxes charged to motor vehicles. And ODOT does, like any good agency should, does revenue projections. They project how much money they're going to get for the next decade or so. And they have projected that, their financial plans count on us burning just as much gasoline a decade from now as we do today. And even though Governor Brown has issued an executive order, and even though the state has had on its statute books for more than a decade a legal goal of reducing greenhouse gases, ODOT's budget plans call for us to create just as much pollution a decade from now from transportation as we do today. So it's an agency that has simply lost sight of broader social goals.
When did it ever have them?
Yeah, a good question. But, arguably you can say we didn't know what, you know, the consequences of this were 50 years ago. You can't make that argument today.
Well, one of the things that I learned about Oregon quite a few years ago was that Oregon was the first state in the Union to absolutely complete its interstate freeway system, north, south, and east, west. Is that true? I mean, I read that a number of years ago.
I don't know if that's true or not. I know we were the first state to implement a gas tax.
But I do know when I traveled across the country a few times by car back in the early 70s, and there were several places that stuck out in my mind as places that didn't have finished freeways. One was New Jersey, where I guess the mob was taking most of the money that was supposed to go to the freeway. Another one was Nevada, where you went through Winnemucca, and I think actually for a while Reno in the early 70s, and you went through on city streets. And California, where I remember it took a really long time before I-5 went bypassed Weed, because when you got to Weed, you'd have to drive through the town of Weed. But when I came here in 1971, all the freeways, I mean, the north, south, and east, west freeways were fait accompli. And another thing that was kind of interesting, I learned when Banfield was building the Banfield Freeway, he was just going to go right by Multnomah Falls, I mean, like right there, and that parking lot that's across the road from Multnomah Falls was going to be, it was all that got built of that freeway. So it seemed like there was a mentality in the 50s through the 70s, in or early 70s in Oregon, that was very freeway crazy.
Well, yeah, absolutely, and everywhere. And, you know, one of the little-known facts is Oregon's freeway system, the Portland's freeway system, was designed in part by Robert Moses from New York. The city fathers of Portland paid Robert Moses in 1943 to come to Portland. And for 2 weeks, he holed up in the Portland Hotel and produced a report on how Portland ought to be built. And the cornerstone of that was a freeway network that had freeways going everywhere in the city, including the I-5 and East Bank and Banfield and Baldock freeways, which today we know is I-5, I-84, and so on.
Did the rest of his plan get built, or was it just those freeways?
No. Thank goodness, you know, starting with the Mount Hood Freeway, we stopped building freeways. But there was a planned Laurelhurst Freeway that would have gone basically up what is now Cesar Chavez Avenue.
And other freeways around the city, a Selwood Freeway and others. Another good example is we all know the Fremont Bridge. So when you go across the Fremont Bridge, if you go into North Portland, there's about a half a mile long ramp that goes from the end of the Fremont Bridge to Vancouver and Williams. And that ramp is actually the stub end of something called the Prescott Expressway, which was supposed to run all the way to the airport. But that was the only piece of it that got built. And that's, you know, the legacy of freeways around Portland, and ODOT's legacy in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s is they built a series of roads that decimated Albina. It wasn't just I-5. It was this Prescott Freeway that was part of the Fremont Bridge. And before that, in the 1950s, they built Interstate Avenue. Interstate Avenue didn't exist as far south or any farther south than about Fremont. And ODOT built a new road. They eliminated houses along the river, basically between the Broadway and steel bridges. And so the reason that neighborhood was decimated was critically due to the decisions of the Oregon Department of Transportation.
That actually sounds like that's really the philosophy of Robert Moses, too, who did the same thing, the way they built freeways or expressways and parkways in New York.
Absolutely. And, you know, the other thing is we now know, looking back over, you know, I'm an economist, so unless you can attach numbers to something, it isn't true. But we know from looking back over seven decades of urban development in the United States that cars kill city neighborhoods, full stop. The closer a city neighborhood was to a freeway after 1950, the more its population declined. The further away it was from a freeway, the better it did. So building freeways, kills urban neighborhoods. And well, that's a key reason why we shouldn't do it.
I've spent a lot of time in the Bay Area, and it always struck me that the biggest difference between Berkeley, where I usually stayed, and Oakland, where I sometimes would stay, is that Berkeley, particularly where I was staying in Berkeley, was really far from the freeway. It's about a 15-minute drive, at least, from the freeway exit to my friend's place. And in Oakland, it's not quite as bad as LA, but there feels like there's freeways every 10 blocks, and many neighborhoods are really cut up by freeways. And I just found it interesting to contrast those two cities and to see the difference in the kind of vitality of neighborhoods when you don't have freeways intersecting all over the place.
Yeah, that's a very big factor in which neighborhoods flourished and which neighborhoods didn't. Part of that is, the people who were most effective in fighting freeways tended to be higher income white people. So, as a result, the freeways got pushed through neighborhoods of color and disproportionately affected lower income people.
Well, that seems to be changing now, because it seems that the people that are fighting particularly fighting the expansion of the freeway around the Broadway corridor. And I'm not sure if it's so much for the supposed bridge replacement, that a lot of those are communities of color and low income communities who are basically saying we've had enough.
I hope so, because I think pretty clearly the construction of the freeways, and then really more importantly, the transformation of the environment into a car-dominated environment devastated those communities. And I think that's the piece that people don't necessarily appreciate about the Rose Quarter is, and they're talking about building a cover over part of the freeway, but actually then widening the freeway considerably. And, you know, I'm not sure anybody wants to spend a lot of time on top of a freeway, not a really nice environment. But more to the point, what a wider freeway does is funnel more cars and more traffic into that area, which if you're a gas station is a terrific thing. But for any other kind of human activity, it has very strong negative effects, and it's really bad for neighborhoods.
Well, this sort of reminds me of a lot of development that happened in Seattle over the last 40 years, and they covered freeways, and they did all kinds of strange things. And I feel like Seattle has just basically made itself worse and worse and worse, and it's just a very difficult city to navigate in. However, I wonder how close do you think Portland is coming to that Seattle model?
I don't know. I think the fate of these I-5 projects will determine a lot about that. You know, whether we decide to squander several $1 billion widening freeways or not. I hope we don't. We were smart enough not to 5 decades ago. I hope we aren't today.
Do you think there's anything we can learn from the process that killed the last proposed Columbia River crossing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, one of the things that the advocates of this project have done is kick down the road all of the questions about how it will be paid for. I mean, this is a $5 billion project. And if you pay a lot of attention, and I do, to what they say, they are very, very sketchy on where the money will come from and who will pay for it. And there's a lot of hand-waving about, there's money in the Biden infrastructure plan and so on. But really what it comes down to is the two states have to initially pay a down payment of probably on the order of at least $1 billion apiece. Okay, that's a $1 billion with a B. And you'll have to get a lot of federal money. And under any circumstances, you're going to have to toll the bridge. And tolling is supposed to make up, according to their financial plan, about a third of the cost of the project. And as soon as people see what those numbers are, you know, that it costs billions of dollars, and they're going to have to pay a toll, that makes folks a lot less excited about this giant project. And that's what killed it last time. And I'll just give you two numbers to think about. The first number is $1,600 a year, $1,600 a year. And that's the amount of tolls that a person living in Clark County and commuting to a job in Oregon would pay every year if they traveled at the rush hour under the tolling system that was developed for the CRC. There are a lot of people in Clark County who would love to have a new bridge. There are very few people in Clark County who want to pay $1,600 a year to have a better bridge. And as soon as that gets framed as a choice, that will, I think, change the project. The other thing we hear is, this bridge is so important to freight, and freight needs to move across the river in our economy. We have a freight-dependent economy, which as an economist is
essentially baloney. But here's the story for trucks. 18-wheel trucks will pay an $18 toll. So every time you cross the Columbia River at peak hour, you're an 18-wheel truck, you have to pay $18. And the average cost of running a big truck like that is about $1.50 a mile. So what that bridge really looks like to a trucker is the financial equivalent of a 10-mile detour. Okay, it's going to cost you another $18. And despite a lot of hand-waving about just-in-time deliveries and so on, and how quickly freight has to move, most freight trucks have long delivery windows. You know, if they get there within about an hour of when they need to be there, it's fine. They don't have really tight. They don't have to be there at a particular minute. They have to be there by some deadline. So unless you can save a lot of time, and unless you're up against that deadline, most truckers don't want to pay a toll, and they don't get reimbursed for it. So there's a study from U.S. Department of Transportation which says truckers don't pay tolls they don't take toll roads because it doesn't provide them any value. So this is a project where we start seriously talking about who will have to pay for it. Those commuters paying $1,600 a year in tolls, those truckers paying $18 every time they cross the bridge. Those people who think they would like to have a bridge will probably feel different when they see what the bill is.
You're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUNN KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with urban economist and opinion leader Joe Courtwright about what's really going on with ODOT and who determines the department's decision-making and why it seems to be so out of step with the direction that Oregon claims to be going in. It's time again to remind you that now is a good time to become a member of KBOO during our winter pledge drive. KBOO receives 80% of our funding from our listeners, but only 10% of listeners are members. Help increase our member ratio and meet our $15,000 goal by going to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321, or you can mail a check to KBOO FM, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. Well, what is the difference between the tolls that you say are going to be so unappreciated and congestion pricing?
Ooh, great question. Because if you build a $5 billion bridge and need to raise at least a third of the cost from tolling, you have to set the tolls really high, like I described. It's about a $3.20 toll for cars and an up to an $18 toll for trucks. But it turns out that you really only need to price the roadway at peak hours. And so you could have much lower tolls if you do congestion pricing. So order is important here. So if you toll the bridge right now and toll it just at the peak hours, you could reduce the congestion really dramatically. And you would probably have a peak hour toll that would be between $1 and $2. And proportionately higher for trucks. If you build a giant $5 billion bridge and then decide to toll it, you have to have enough money to pay back the bonds that you issued to build the bridge, which means your tolls have to be a lot higher. So that's really the key difference, is we could manage our congestion problem without incurring a lot of debt and have a lower level of tolls.
I wanted to talk about equity issues, because you talk about how the history of freeways is basically plowing down communities of color and low-income communities and destroying the fabric of really old, vibrant communities. But on the other hand, it seems that ODOT is promoting the Interstate Bridge Replacement Project as being an equity project. So how is it being promoted as being concerned with equity, and how does it deal with the historic inequity of previous freeway projects?
Yeah, in my view, there's nothing equitable about it. And, you know, I've looked at the demographics of peak hour commuters from Clark County, and the average income of people who drive from Clark County, from homes in Clark County to jobs in Oregon at the peak hour, is $106,000 a year. And 86% of the people who drive from Clark County to jobs in Oregon at the peak hour are non-Hispanic white people. So if you're concerned about equity, spending $5 billion to help folks whose incomes are mostly over $100,000 and who are disproportionately whiter and less Latino than the rest of the population is not my idea of equity. I'm not sure it's anybody's idea of equity.
So they still are using it as justification. Of course, this kind of reminds me of the frack gas industry talking about renewable natural gas and all these things that they buzz it. You had an interesting word. I think you used it. You call it equity washing, how they're proposing this?
Equity washing, woke washing. Yeah. There's a lot of, again, sort of, you know, this is a project that has spent, this is the IBR project, Interstate Bridge Replacement Project, has spent between $4 and $5 million on public relations and communication. They're all about crafting messages to sell this stuff that have a limited basis in reality and then ignore key facts. And, you know, if we talk about equity in the transportation system, the most important equity issue, and it really underlies all of them, is that we have a two-cased transportation system in the United States.
People who are wealthy enough to own cars and old enough to drive them and not too infirm or too old to drive them are first-class citizens. Everybody else is a second-class citizen in our transportation system. And this project does almost nothing to redress that balance. In fact, it spends an enormous amount of money further privileging the people who are most advantaged by this two-cased transportation system that we have, which to me is the opposite of equity.
How far north would the freeway widening go? And so which communities would it be most benefiting?
It's almost 5 miles long from the Vancouver end to the Portland end.
So 2 miles north of Vancouver, so reaching towards Battle Creek.
2 miles north of the river into Vancouver, so city still within the city limits. But that's a roadway that's chiefly used by commuters from Vancouver, from Battleground, and points north of the northern suburbs of Clark County.
So I'm wondering how the communities are responding, and how also elected officials, whether it's the city, the county, Metro Council on the Oregon side, are responding to this. Does it seem like this is winning their favor?
Well, you know, again, Oregon Department of Transportation, Washington Department of Transportation are extremely well-funded and are devoting a lot of resources to marketing this project and devoting a lot of attention to local political leaders. So I think one of the big challenges is just to get more opportunity to talk with our political leaders about what this project really is. It's not a bridge replacement. It's much bigger than that. And talk about what its consequences are. So that's, I think that's really the key to changing the debate on this. And to their credit, on January 6th, the Metro Council had a hearing on the project and heard from a lot of voices, from No More Freeways, from community groups and others, challenging a lot of the premises that are being offered by the highway departments. And I think they expressed a number of misgivings. I hope they continue to be vigilant and take a very close look at this project, because I think the more they learn about it, the more they'll realize it's fundamentally at odds with a lot of the other goals that they say they support.
Well, they were poised to vote for a certain amount of funding for it, I understand.
They actually did go ahead providing an additional $36 million in funding for the project.
They did that despite the fact that they heard that it might be a really bad project?
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, their view is, the rationalization was, we need to spend some money to get answers to critical questions. Frankly, I think we already know the answers to those questions, but they didn't. But if they take the next couple of months to get the right answer to this, and we avoid wasting $5 billion, that $36 million will not seem so consequential.
Though it sure could have funded some things that we really need to fund.
Absolutely.
Well, you wrote an article recently equating Metro Council with some of the characters in the film Don't Look Up. What was that about?
Well, it's about climate change. Yeah, and, you know, so in Oregon and Portland, you know, we talk a good game, or at least our political leaders talk a good game about how much we're concerned about climate. You know, we talk about the Paris Accords. We talk about how we want to reduce greenhouse gases. The city and the state both have adopted greenhouse goals that say by 2050, you know, we're going to get those greenhouse gases down to, you know, a quarter of what they were in 1990. Of course, everybody who's making that pledge will long be out of office or dead by the time 2050 rolls around. But when you look at the actual trajectory of greenhouse gas emissions in the Portland metropolitan area or in the state, the tragic fact is greenhouse gases from transportation in Portland have increased by about 20% in the last 5 years. And not only are we, quote, not making progress fast enough, we're actually going in the wrong direction. And that's in spite of the fact that we have, you know, Metro has what they call a climate smart strategy, and the city of Portland has a climate action plan, both of which call for us to make steady reductions in greenhouse gases. And the tragic fact is they're not looking to see whether they're making progress on their stated climate plans. They have a long checklist of actions that they say they're going to take, but they're not asking, is what we're doing enough, and is it enough to actually move the needle?
What are some of the things on that action list?
You know, there are a laundry list of things like, well, we need, you know, we need better insulation in houses, and we need more fuel efficient cars, and we need better land use planning, and we need, you know, vehicle electrification, you know, electric charging stations. Long list of, you know, not necessarily bad ideas, but ultimately you have to ask the question, is it enough to actually move the needle? And it's like, you know, in the final scenes, if you watch the movie Don't Look Up, the comet is there in the sky and people can look up and see it and it is getting closer. And yet a bunch of people are saying, I'm not even going to look. And that's, unfortunately, I think where we are. And I will point to the staffs of these agencies, to City of Portland, Metro Council, Oregon Department of Transportation. We have an inventory of greenhouse gases. We know how much greenhouse gases we emit, and we know that we're emitting 20% more than we did 5 years ago, in spite of our stated plans to do otherwise. And that one fact makes essentially everything else that they're talking about irrelevant. That is, if you're not reducing your greenhouse gases, then it doesn't matter what's on your checklist. Your checklist is wrong.
Do they know that we aren't reducing our greenhouse gases?
I don't know. I can't tell from the reports that I've seen. So I'll pick on Metro here. So Metro adopted their climate smart strategy in 2014. They said, well, we're going to monitor our greenhouse gas emissions. And for the last couple of years, they produced a report that reports the greenhouse gas emissions for Metro, but Metro as if it were a corporation. You know, how much emissions do Metro's vehicles emit? How much methane comes from animals at the zoo? How much is from landfills and landfill operations? And the real issue is not whether Metro, you know, runs its ship tighter. It's Metro is trying to take responsibility for the whole transportation system. And that's what we need to be paying attention to. And as far as I can tell from the printed material that I've seen from Metro, they aren't paying attention to the fact that greenhouse gases have increased by 20% in the last 5 years.
So where do you find that information out that they're not seeing it?
Well, you might turn to scientists, like scientists who work for NASA and the federal government, and who do something. There's a project called DARTE, Project DARTE, and I forget. Ask me what DARTE stands for, because I don't know. But what it is a national inventory of greenhouse gas emissions from transportation down to a 1 kilometer cell level. So it's a very finely grained inventory of greenhouse gases in the United States, and produced for the U.S. Department of Energy by folks who work for NASA.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Kibwe Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with urban economist and opinion leader Joe Cartwright about what's going on with ODOT and how their proposals and priorities seem to be a little out of whack with what Oregon claims to be trying to do. And I want to remind you that now is a good time to become a member of KBOO during our Winter Pledge Drive. KBOO has trained thousands of people how to make radio, all for free, thanks to the support we receive from our members. So please support this vital community institution and meet our $15,000 goal by going to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or you can mail a check to KBOO FM, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. Well, Joe, in the last part of the show, I would like to get a sense from you. If you were running the Oregon Department of Transportation, what would you be doing differently from what they're doing?
Well, I think we know that cars and transportation are the largest source of greenhouse gases in Oregon, in the United States, and they're the ones that are growing. So we have to take a very, very different attitude towards the automobile than we have in the past. We need to be reducing the amount of driving that Oregonians are doing and making it essentially possible for them to live car light and car less lifestyles, fewer cars, fewer miles. So in medical terms, you know, there's the Hippocratic Oath. And the first rule, the Hippocratic Oath, is first do no harm. And we know building more road capacity does harm. So the very first thing we should do is stop widening roadways. and ODOT has plans to spend upwards of $10 billion widening roadways in the Portland metropolitan area. And their plan for paying for that is to issue a whole bunch of debt, to issue bonds. Essentially what they're doing is building these freeways that are going to make the climate situation worse and send the bill for the freeways to our children. That's the first most important thing to do, is to block doing that. There are a lot of things that we can do after that. You know, we could be spending money on housing, to provide housing closer to where people want to be in the neighborhoods that they want to live in, rather than having sprawling housing. We could be investing in transportation alternatives, improving transit, making walking and cycling safer and more competitive than they are. And there are a whole bunch of other things we could do. You know, we can promote electricity, both in transit and private automobiles. But the key thing to do is to stop doing the wrong things. So that's, if I were at ODOT, that's what I would be doing.
Well, among the many wrong things that ODOT has appeared to me to be doing over the many years, and particularly recently, was clear-cutting a whole bunch of old-growth trees along the Santiam Highway in the name of taking out hazard trees after the big fires on Labor Day weekend 2020. And when I was reading about how ODOT oversaw this, what seemed like really somewhere between corrupt and incompetent boondoggle for all this logging, it made me really wonder, who is running ODOT and how does this stuff happen? And what is it about the culture of ODOT that allows this to be? And so one big question is there corruption? I mean, what's going on? So what's your sense about why this kind of behavior seems to be so rampant in ODOT?
Well, I'll give you one parallel example, which I can comment on, which is, so there's the I-5 Rose Quarter project. So they're proposing to widen Interstate 5 through the Rose Quarter near the Moda Center in downtown Portland. And we know that that roadway and the other I-5 projects devastated Albina. They caused a 60% drop in the population of that neighborhood. And ODOT at least nominally said, oh yeah, we're sorry. You know, we're sorry we wiped out the primary black neighborhood, what was the primary black neighborhood in Portland. But our solution to that is we're going to come in and widen that freeway, but put a cover over it. And it's like, if you really wanted to restore that neighborhood, you'd either be talking about eliminating that freeway or doing something to reduce the traffic there. And the same thing is true, it strikes me, with the forest, that you know, highway departments have been infamous for, in the name of safety, creating quote-unquote clear zones on the side of highways by cutting down trees and removing buildings and vegetation. And what clear zones do is they encourage people to drive faster. You know, that's especially true in urban environments, but it's actually true in all environments. So it actually has the perverse effect of making the situation worse. But from the standpoint of highway engineers, you know, they're all about wider, faster, bigger, and more pavement. And that attitude, that belief structure is just deeply ingrained into the way they do everything. And they subordinate the landscape and human activity to making things nominally more convenient for automobiles. And, you know, I think it's that intellectual or ideological corruption that's really at the root of these problems. If you perceive the critical objective as being making the world a better place for vehicles, you make it a worse place for humans and nature.
Well, do you see any way to change the agency? Do you see any way to change its culture, maybe change its personnel?
I don't know. I mean, I think, again, I think the big project, you know, we hearken back to like the killing of the Mount Hood Freeway. I think that had a salutary effect on a whole bunch of transportation agencies for a long time. I think these big battles, like the battle over the Rose Quarter, the battle over the interstate bridge replacement, these are signal events that allow the public to voice its opinion in a way that can have significant, if not permanent, impacts on the belief structures of the agencies, and then also can reshape the political forces around this. Because ultimately, you know, the Oregon Legislature, Metro Council, City of Portland Council can all have an impact on this. You know, when you think about what killed the Mount Hood Freeway, it was Governor McCall, Mayor Goldschmidt, deciding that the political winds were there to kill this project. And I think that's kind of what needs to happen with these projects. And hopefully that creates a powerful lesson that then sends us in a different direction going forward.
So how do you see stirring up those political winds?
Oh, well, you know, if any Wednesday afternoon you want to, or I think it's every other Wednesday afternoon, you want to go to ODOT headquarters, there's a group of
Well-spoken, very articulate young climate activists who are saying,
this is ground zero for fighting climate change.
And, you know, show up at your city council
hearing, metro hearing, ODOT hearings, and everything else, and let your voice be heard.
And tell people that, you know, this is not what I want for my community, not what I want for my planet.
I mean, one of the things that to me is symbolically really disturbing about the widening of the Rose Quarter Freeway is it's going to go right by, impinge totally on the Harriet Tubman Middle School. So they're talking about moving the middle school. And so the first place they're going to move it to was the existing King Elementary School, or it's actually a K-8 school. So you're going to eradicate one black school for another one. That plan, I think, has been bollocksed, but it still seems to me like there should be something in our thinking where we go, if you have to move a middle school to widen a freeway, there's something really wrong with that picture.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, one of the ironies here is we were talking about equity earlier. When Harriet Tubman Middle School was reopened about 5 years ago, Portland Public Schools had to spend something on the order of $12 to $15 million putting in air cleaning equipment to make the air inside the school clean enough for the students to breathe. And they had to pay for that with their own money. It wasn't paid for by the Oregon Department of Transportation. It wasn't paid for by the commuters driving up and down the road there, or the trucks going up and down the road. It came out of money that could otherwise have been used to help those kids, you know, learn. And to me, that's criminal that essentially, we're subsidizing people's pollution by forcing the school district to pay to clean up the air that's being polluted by the folks on the freeway. And just for the record, that school building, which was originally built as the Elliott School, predates the I-5 freeway by more than a decade. So the freeway was built right by the school and not the other way around. So if anything, Oregon Department of Transportation ought to be paying for that school. And that's, you know, apparently Governor Brown is saying she's going to use other money, general fund money, money that could be used for just about anything to pay for moving the school, which could cost another $160 million. And again, that's money that, in my view, if you move the school at all, it ought to be paid for by the people who are causing this problem, which are the people, and this includes me, people who are driving on that freeway.
I'm wondering if there's any way to change the personnel at ODOT. With a new governor coming in a couple of years, is it possible to maybe restaff who runs ODOT?
Yeah, probably. I'm not, not an expert in sort of human resources. I think more, just as perhaps more importantly, you've got to change. You probably have to do both. You probably need new people. But above all, you need to sort of change the political outlook, political forces.
Well, Joe, it's great to talk to you. And I hope that we are encouraging people to get out there and to raise their voices for things that really matter.
Absolutely. And such a pleasure talking to you, Barbara, and to the audience.
And people can catch your writing at City Observatory.
Yeah, we have weekly commentary on a range of urban policy issues at cityobservatory.org.
Great. Well, thanks again for being on Locus Focus, Joe.
My pleasure.
We've been talking with urban economist and opinion leader Joe Courtwright, and you've been listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of the show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO in the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us during our Winter Pledge Drive by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll talk with Julia DeGraw with the Oregon League of Conservation Voters about the short Oregon legislative session, which will be drawing to a close soon. We'll go out with a song by the Talking Heads. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance when necessary and wear a mask.